Okay, let's read God's word. We're going to read a few verses from Revelation chapter 3. Those of you who know the book of Revelation will know that this is the last kind of book of the New Testament. And in the first chapter, we get an introduction to Jesus. John sees him and has a revelation of him. And then the next two chapters, there are a series of letters, seven letters in all, to seven different churches found in the part of the planet we now call Turkey. And Jesus writes to these churches with messages for them. And this is the message to one of those churches. It's the church in Philadelphia. It's Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. And we read, "To the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I know your deeds. See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. I will make those who are of the synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Since you have kept my command to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. I am coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one may take your crown. The one who is victorious, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will they leave it. I will write on them the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God. And I will also write on them my new name. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches." And the Lord will bless his truth to our hearts for Christ's sake. Amen. So, my sabbatical is over. 5 weeks have passed, and here I am back among you again in Carnmoney. And people ask me questions about it. Everybody says to me, "Did I enjoy it?" Everybody says, "Am I rested?" Everybody says, "Would I do it again?" The answer is yes, no, yes. Yes, I enjoyed it. No, I'm not rested. And yes, I would do it again tomorrow. So, however, the whole exercise was meant to be about listening. It was meant to be an opportunity to listen to what God might be saying to us, to me, and to you and me together as we try to work out God's purposes for us in this place at this time. And that was kind of when I had to make a pitch to the authorities of our denominations to whether or not they would allow me to go at their expense for 5 weeks and do this. I had to say, "Look, I just want to listen." They would have had every reason to say, "I've never heard anything so ridiculous in all my life. I mean, what is it that would make you think or anybody else think that God might have something very specific to say to you personally and a Carnmoney church collectively? I mean, why would you even think that that was the case?" Now, if we weren't Carnmoney, but if we were this church, which is Mae Young Sung Presbyterian Church in Seoul in South Korea, okay? It might be different if we were that church. That church is the largest Presbyterian church in the world. It has 1 million members, okay? They have seven services on a Sunday. There's the inside of the building. It's not unlike ours, just a little bit bigger. They have seven services on a Sunday, two services on a Saturday, and as well as that, they video their service out to 10 other locations around Seoul on Sunday during the time that they're meeting in that building, okay? As well as that, they were only founded in 1980. They've had the same pastor since from the beginning until now. So they only founded in 1980, and during the time between 1980 and now, apart from growing the way they have grown, they have also planted an additional 30 churches in other parts of South Korea. Now, if you were to say God would have an interest in that church, you would think, well, yeah, I dare say he does. I mean, it's big, it's influential, it has done a whole series of incredible things for him. Of course, God would be interested in them, but would he really be interested in us? I mean, we don't even come close by any standard of measurement to that place. Well, you might say that, But then you remember that at the beginning of the book of Revelation, Jesus writes a letter to seven churches. And one of them was the church in Philadelphia. Now, that is not the Philadelphia I spent 10 days in a couple of weeks ago in the United States. Okay, just to get that clear, this Philadelphia is a place in modern Turkey. It was a city that was in existence at that point in time. Actually, the city still exists. It's not called Philadelphia now. It's called Al-Sahir, and you can still visit it to this day. So it's there. It is a place. And Jesus writes to this church. And here's what he says about the church. He says, I know your deeds. I know what you're doing. I know that you have little strength. The church in Philadelphia wasn't very big. It was a lot smaller than Carmony. It didn't have much influence. Not very many people belonged to it. It didn't have a lot of resources. It certainly hadn't just spent £2.4 million putting up a nice new building out the back. And yet Jesus takes the time to write to that church. And not only to that church, but to six other churches in modern Turkey. And in the letter that Jesus writes to that church, and this is the picture of the remains of a church in Al-Sahir. You can see it if you travel there to Turkey. Okay, now it's not the church to which Jesus is writing. This building was built much later, probably in the 3rd or 4th century. But it shows that a church that was founded there continued to grow and could put up a building like this, which is now in ruins, and you can see it. Jesus writes to this church. And when he writes to the church, it's really interesting what he knows about that church. Because we discover that Jesus displays accurate knowledge of what they've been doing and the situation they find themselves in. So even though they're small, not very influential, Jesus has been taking an interest in them. Furthermore, in the letter, he sets out six ways by which he intends to continue to connect with them and be involved with them going forward from this point. And he encourages the church to pay attention to what he's saying because he's serious about it. And it's amazing. It's amazing. Jesus is writing a letter to this small church, and in all these different ways, he is showing that he's interested in the life of that church, that he's involved in the life of that church, and that he wants that church to pick up and hear what he has to say. And in these seven letters that he writes to these churches, not only does he write to the church as a whole, but in some of the letters, he mentions specific groups of people that are inside the church, and on one or two occasions, he mentions particular individuals in the lives of those churches. And you can only conclude for one thing from this. You can only conclude that the church thing actually means something to Jesus. That he is interested not in some kind of general way. It's not that Jesus is just a big picture guy. He kind of sits above it all and says, whoa, the church is growing. There's now, you know, one third of the world's population claim to be Christian. That's really great. And he sees the big picture stuff. Jesus sees individual members, groups of people, the life and times of this small church in Philadelphia, and he bothers to send them a message about it. And that kind of challenges me in a way. Because loads of times people will come, you know, maybe come to you with a word from God that they feel they received for your life. You know, maybe you go for prayer ministry some Sunday and the person praying with you says, I think God might be saying, and they say something that's really relevant to someone that's going on in your life just that time. Somebody gives you a scripture verse or a verse of a song and you realize God has spoken to you. Sometimes people come to me and they will say to me, I had a dream or I was in my devotions the other day, I was praying on I-56 and God gave me this picture and I think it might be for the church. And we receive those things, but we pay very little attention to them. And Jesus writes to this church in Philadelphia and he says, look, I know what you're doing and I know how things are and I'm going to be committed to working with you in the days to come. We're going to have some adventures together. And then he says, I want you to pay attention to what I'm telling you. Man, it just, whoa, over the top of our heads. We don't stop to listen and think that Jesus is interested in us. So what was Jesus trying to tell the church in Philadelphia? Because after the last 5 or 6 weeks, we're having the chance to think about this. Some of these things in this letter to the church in Philadelphia, I kind of thought it was It's kind of cool in a way that it should be the letter to the church in Philadelphia, seeing as that's where I spent some time, that God seemed to be bringing me back to all the time. But there's a couple of things in here that I think we need to hear that Jesus wanted the Christians in Philadelphia to hear 2,000 years ago. What is Jesus talking to them about? Here's the first thing. He's talking to them about a gift. There's something that Jesus has done for the church in Philadelphia. Revelation chapter 3, verse 8, we read, "See," he says, "I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut." The verb in that sentence, which is translated, "I have placed before you," is more normally translated, "I have given you." I have given you an open door. What does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean that the doors in the church in Philadelphia were badly swollen and wouldn't close, okay? That isn't what it means. They didn't have a building at this time when Jesus wrote to them anyway. So what does it mean? Well, in the letter, we discover that like most churches in the first century, the church in Philadelphia was born inside the synagogue. So you remember how it was in the book of the Acts when Paul's going out on missionary journeys and he's preaching to people and planting churches? He always goes, first of all, to the local Jewish synagogue and he speaks to them. And then what happened, the loads of those times to Paul also happened to the church in Philadelphia. Eventually, the leaders of the local synagogue decided they didn't like this teaching, they didn't want anything to do with Jesus Christ, and they kicked the Christians out of the synagogue. And that's what had happened in Philadelphia. Now, having been thrown out of the synagogue created a lot of difficulties for these believers. For one thing, it was a rejection. The Jewish people from whom the Messiah had come were saying, "Listen, guys, we're the real deal. You guys are not. Get out." And that was difficult for these young believers because these people who had been in the tradition and the succession of God's word over centuries were saying to them, "Look, I don't know where you heard this stuff, but this stuff is not right." For another thing, having been thrown out of the synagogue, not only did it maybe make them question, "Well, are we sure we're right about this? Because these guys don't seem to think we're right." Also, this situation created a problem for the fledgling church because they found themselves exposed in the Roman Empire at a time when the Roman Empire grudgingly accepted Judaism, grudgingly accepted the Jewish faith. But it didn't really accept anybody outside the mainstream. So what actually happened here was that for much of the early period of time in the young Christian church, everybody thought Christianity was a sect of Judaism. Well, they met in synagogues. A lot of them were Jewish in their national background. And Jesus was a Jew. This guy they talked about lived in Palestine. So in the early years, everybody thought Christianity was a sect of Judaism. Judaism was kind of protected inside the empire. So if you were considered to be part of the Jewish religion, you were probably safe-ish. Once it became clear you weren't part of the Jewish religion, you were potentially in difficulty with the Roman authorities. And about this situation, Jesus says two things. First thing he says is this. He says, these people who chucked you out of the synagogue say they're getting rid of you because they're the real deal and you're not. And Jesus says to them, who's the real deal? In Revelation 3:7, we read, to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut. What he shuts, no one can open. Who's the real deal? Is it the leaders of the synagogue in Philippi? The Christian believers who have been thrown out? Well, it turns out it's neither of the two. The real deal is Jesus himself. These are the words of him who is, and you could translate this phrase literally, this is how it would go. These are the words of him who is the holy and the true. Who is the real deal? Jesus Christ himself. That's what he's saying here. He is the real deal, not the leaders of the synagogue in Philippi. And he says, because he is the real deal, he admits to the kingdom and not the leaders of the synagogue in Philippi. Actually, he says they're liars. Not only are they not the real deal, they're not even vaguely true. It is Jesus who is the real deal. It is he who holds the key of David. It is Jesus and Jesus alone who admits people to the kingdom of God. We're going to have a membership class this week, and Michael and I will talk to folks who come about who we are as a church, what our priorities and values are, and we will invite people to become members of the church, and if they decide that they want to do that, then they'll come and bear witness before you here at some service in the not-too-distant future. The members of the Kirk Session will welcome them into membership of the church. So who let you into this church? Turns out it's not the minister. Turns out it's not the elders. It's not the Presbyterian, it's not the General Assembly. Only one person holds the key of David, and his name is Jesus Christ. He opens the door to the kingdom. If he lets you in, you're in. So when we receive members into the church, what are we doing? We're simply recognizing in a public way something that we believe Jesus Christ has already done. I hold the key of David. I'm the real deal. So Jesus said, if you got thrown out of the synagogue, I don't want you to be worried about that, because the people who threw you out of the synagogue had no right to let you in and no right to throw you out. That's my job. But there's something else. Because when these people who heard this message from Jesus, okay, that affirms them now, so they can forget about all that worry and they were doing, well, maybe we're not right. Maybe these people are right. Jesus is saying, don't pay any attention to them. They're a bunch of liars. I'm the real deal. I'll let you in. Nobody has the right to exclude you. Then they got to think about that. They realized something else. They realized, well, if we got in, anybody could get in. I mean, we're nothing special. Loads of these people were just serving people. They didn't have any status in society in Philadelphia, even though it was a significant city. They weren't important, they weren't influential, they weren't significant, but they got into the kingdom. Jesus opened the door and they got in. They thought, right, well, if we got in, anybody could get in. Anybody who accepts the authority of Jesus Christ, the Lord, anybody could get in. All they had to do was to tell people that. They had to get out and spread the message. Jesus has opened the door. It's a gift to the church. He's opened the door. Nobody can shut it. If you want to come in, you can come in. It was like when Paul and Barnabas returned from their first missionary journey. They come back to Antioch. The church has sent them out, and they tell the church in Antioch what had happened. Here's what we read in Acts 14. On arriving there, they gathered the church together and reported all that God had done through them and how God had opened a door of faith for the Gentiles. God opened a door. Did you ever think about that? Do you ever think about the fact that Jesus says, I give you a gift? I give Carn Money Church a gift. Gift I give you is I open the door. Nobody else gets to shut it. Do you know what that means? That means you live with people every day. You work with people. You shop with people. You play sport with people. People who are just like you. You are related to some of them. You love many of them. You have similar interests and similar lifestyles, and you live in the same area. Loads and loads of people who are just the same as you. Do you ever think about the fact that if you got into the kingdom through faith in Jesus Christ, so can they? That if Jesus opened the door for us and nobody gets to put us out, then it's just the same for all those other people that you walk with and live with and fellowship with every single day of your life. And all you have to do is tell them. All you have to do is tell them. Jesus invites you to come in. You got into the kingdom, and so could they. And that's Jesus' assurance to the church. Look, I've given you a gift. It doesn't matter what the Jews say. I opened the door. Nobody else gets to close it. You got in. So don't you see the fact that all these other people you know who are just like you can get in as well? You need to go and tell them about what I've done. But it gets even better than that. Because we read in Revelation chapter 3, verse 9, I will make those who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. Here's the other thing that Jesus said. You can go out into the marketplace and you can talk to all these people who are just like you, and you can tell them that the door is open for them and that they can come in, and they will respond, because when I open the door, nobody gets to shut it. But he said, you can go and tell those Jewish people who chucked you out of the synagogue that the door is open for them as well, and they will come in. Turns out they did. Because 20 years after this letter was written, A guy called Ignatius, who was the bishop of Antioch, was traveling to Rome, where he would be judged and where he would suffer the fate of dying for his faith in the Colosseum in Rome. And when he's traveling from Antioch, where he is a church leader, to Rome, he writes a series of letters to churches that he has had responsibility for during his life of Christian leadership. And guess what? One of the churches he writes a letter to is the church in Philadelphia. And he commends that church for all the things that it has been doing, but he warns that church about a problem that they face. The problem, apparently, that this church in Philadelphia was facing was that in the church there was a group of people who were seeking to influence the church to Judaizing their Christianity. That there was a group of people in the church who were trying to say to the church, look, this is an amazing church and that things are going really well, but you know we've got a Jewish heritage here and we maybe need to look at some of these things and they should be an important life of who we are. It's not just enough to kind of be following Jesus, but we need to bring this stuff in from our Jewish background. Now, who do you think might be the people in the church in Philadelphia who were saying those things? They have to be the leaders of the synagogue, who once were opposed to Christ, who threw the young believers out of the synagogue, but who have now come to faith in Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, and who are struggling to relate their newfound faith in Jesus to the traditions of their Jewish upbringing. Jesus said, I open a door, and when I open a door, nobody gets to shut it. And the people who are going to come in through that door are people just like you and people who are totally different from you. There's an article in the latest edition of Christianity magazine, and the article is entitled Muslims Turning to Christ, a Global Phenomenon. And the article is written by an academic researcher who's a Christian believer who has contact with a lot of Christian groups in the Muslim world, and he writes about his experiences and what has been happening amongst the Islamic kind of nations in recent years. It turns out that Christians were highly unsuccessful at bringing people to faith from Muslim backgrounds through century after century after century. The reason for that was that there was such animosity between those who were in the Islamic faith and who were living in Islamic nations. It turns out there was so much animosity between them and Christians, indeed other faiths as well, that what Christian missionaries did, literally for hundreds of years, what Christian churches did was they gave a wide berth to Islamic areas. And they rarely did effective witnessing of any kind into lands that were Muslim in their faith. About 23 years ago, a small group of Christians started to pray for and with Muslims during Ramadan, the big Muslim feast. And something started to happen. When this prayer thing started, something started to happen. What happened was that all across the Islamic world, groups of people started coming to faith, sometimes without any direct connection with Christian missionaries. And an incredible thing has taken place in that the person who writes this article is now in contact with some 69 groups of believers living and working in Islamic lands. And several of those groups contain tens of thousands of people converted in the last few years from Islam to Christianity. And one of the incredible things in the article is this. The tools that God has been using to bring those people to faith. One of the tools, you won't probably find this hard to believe, but one of the tools that God has been using to bring people from an Islamic background to faith in Jesus Christ is the Quran. Because in 1982, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia initiated a program. The program was to translate the Quran into all the languages of the world. Now, you would think, well, this is a bad job for Christians, because actually the Quran is written in Arabic. The vast majority of Muslims don't speak Arabic. They live in other countries. They don't live in that part of the world. And so they had to learn a language they didn't know to read the Quran. And though they could read it, they really didn't understand it. So King Fahd had this idea, this mission, that he would provide the finance to translate the Quran into all the languages of the world. And this has been going on since 1982. The article tells the story of a guy called Ahmed who lives in Southeast Asia. And when the Quran was translated into his language, he's a Muslim, he bought a copy of the Quran, he read it. And he testifies that when he read the Quran, he was devastated. The reason why he was devastated was he discovered when he read the Quran that there was no salvation for him. That there was no way whereby his sins could be forgiven, his life could be changed, and things could be okay between him and God, and he was totally devastated. But he noticed something else as well. He noticed as he read the Quran that the Quran said very little of a complimentary nature about the Prophet Muhammad. It recorded his sayings and the things that ostensibly God had revealed to him, but it said very little about him as a person. But what he noticed was that the Quran was full of praise of Jesus. And this struck him as really odd because that wasn't what he was expecting when he read the Quran. You see, so that Jesus is mentioned quite frequently in the Quran and mentioned complimentarily. So he got a copy of the New Testament and he read it. And you know where the story is going. He came to faith in Jesus Christ. And then he started to talk about this to lots of his friends. And loads of his friends went through a similar experience and came to faith in Jesus Christ. Who would have thought that it was possible that God could use the Quran to bring people to Christ? Except, of course, that Jesus said, I opened a door and nobody gets to shut the door I opened. That doesn't just include the people we like. And it doesn't just include the people who like us. It includes everyone. Jesus said, I open a door and nobody gets to shut the door. Jesus has given us in this church a gift. The gift he gave us was of an open door. And it was an incredible gift. Why? Because that open door let us in. Without that open door of Jesus Christ, I wouldn't have got in. You wouldn't have got in. We're all sinful people. We don't deserve to be in. We deserve to be out. But because Christ opened the door, and through acceptance of him and through faith in him, we got in through the door. But hey, if we got in through the door, anybody can get in through the door. All we have to do is get out there with the message that the door is open. People who are like us and people who are totally different from us can come to know Christ and can get in through the door. Jesus gave us a gift. Guys, we need to do something with the gift. We need to do something with the gift. If we want to have a way of assessing the effectiveness of our work, here's one way we could do it. Whatever area of work of the church you're involved in, when was the last time somebody like you or somebody unlike you came to faith in Jesus Christ through the open door Christ put in front of us? Jesus said, I didn't ask you to do very much, you know. I opened the door. I just asked you to go and tell people that the door's open. We need to get serious about this. This matters to Christ. He's given us a gift. What are we going to do with the gift? He's talking corporately to the church here. This is perhaps more about the leadership of the church, the leadership of our ministries and all the things that we do than it is necessarily about us as individuals. Of course, as individuals, we need to be witnesses. But this is really corporately addressed to the church. What is the leadership of this church doing with that gift? What's the minister doing with it? What are the elders doing with it? What are the leaders of the organization, the ministries of the church doing with that gift? The gift of the open door. But then Jesus said something else. He said there was a promise. Jesus tells his people in Philadelphia to hold on. Revelation 3 verse 10, since you have kept my command to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. Hold on to what you have so that no one will take your crown. See, the point was that Jesus writes to the church in Philadelphia, and at that point in time, Domitian was the Roman emperor. And there was a massive persecution going on of a number of religious groups, which probably included the Jews, but definitely included the Christian church at this very point in time, which meant that when the young believers in Philadelphia were cast out of the Jewish synagogue and started to testify to their faith, the people they worked with and the people all around them every day, they made themselves targets for Domitian's hatred. And there was a strong persecution going on, and it was tough going. And Jesus tells them, look, I know all about it, and you'll never be alone in it, because he said, I'm going to be with you in it. The translation that says, I'm going to keep you from it, probably is not as good as as translated, that Jesus was implying that he would walk with them in it. It's going to come and it's going to be hard, but I'm going to be there with you. You'll never be alone. What I need you to do, Jesus said, is hold on. I need you, even though I know it's costly, because every time you do it, you make yourself a target. I need you to keep bringing people through the open door. What was Jesus saying? He was saying, just as the Jews can't keep you out of the kingdom, the Gentiles can't take your crown. And hold on, they did. History tells us that the town of Philadelphia in this part of Turkey was the last region to fall to the Ottoman Empire in the 14th century. That empire, which was based in Turkey but which spread around the Mediterranean, both sides of the Mediterranean, and at its extent included a huge amount of territory where the Ottoman Turks kind of basically conquered all those lands and turned them into Muslim countries over a period of several hundreds of years. And the last city to fall in that region of Philadelphia was Philadelphia itself. They held on. They held on. Now we're into the middle of the 14th century. But it, even whenever the Turks came in and they took over that part of the world, the church didn't die. In fact, at the start of the 20th century, 22% of the population of Turkey was still Christian. Almost a quarter of the population of Turkey was still Christian at that point in time. Now, the 20th century was a century of persecution. Now, today, Christian population in Turkey is 0.32%. Huge reduction during that century. But you know what? In 1933, when Robertson wrote his word study commentaries on the New Testament, he says in his commentary on Revelation 3 in this chapter we're looking at, that when he was penning those words in 1933, there was still a church of more than 1,000 people in Alashahir in Turkey. And as we meet here in Carnmoney this morning, although we have no direct contact with them at this point in time, it is almost certainly the case that men and women who are brothers and sisters of yours and mine in Jesus Christ are meeting to worship him in Alashahir today, 2,000 years after Jesus told that church to just hold on. How did they do that? Through all this persecution and all this opposition and all the problems that they as the people of God have faced in that part of Turkey throughout all these years, how on earth did they do it? Here's how they did it. They did it because they believed the promise of Jesus. Jesus said, I am coming soon. Why was that significant? That was significant for this reason. The believers in Turkey weren't looking for the world to get better. They were looking for Jesus to come back. And there's a vast difference between those two things. Of course, the gospel, when it impacts and influences society, changes society's values and changes life in the world. And we can point to all sorts of ways in which the preaching of the gospel right across the planet has changed lots of things during history. But the reality is the world is still a pretty bad place to live for lots of people. And if the people in Philadelphia had been looking for the world to get better, they'd have given up on the Christian faith centuries ago. But that wasn't what they were looking for. They were looking for Jesus to fulfill his promise. And Jesus' promise was, I'm coming back. And they wanted to be a part of that. So here's what they did. Jesus describes it in a very powerful metaphor in these verses. They became like pillars in a temple. Roman buildings had loads of pillars. This is the Acropolis in Greece, okay? You can see them all across the Roman Empire. If you go on your holidays to that part of the world, maybe you visited some of these ruins. Loads of pillars. Most of those pillars were there to support the roof, but actually the architects who built the building realized there's other things you can do with pillars. And one of the things you can do with pillars is you can put inscriptions on them. And so over the years, these buildings would have inscriptions on the pillars, which were ways of remembering significant people in society, maybe somebody who gave a generous gift to build the temple or somebody else who was a key leader and who left behind a good reputation. And their names would be inscribed and some details about their memories on these pillars in temples and other places like that. And here's what Jesus said. The one who is victorious, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God. Never again will they leave it. I will write on them the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which is coming down out of heaven from my God, and I will also write on them my new name. These pillars in Roman temples were branded. They were branded with the names of significant people whom society should remember. And you can go all around this church, and on some items of furnishings and plaques on the wall behind, you will see the names of people who were significant followers of Jesus Christ in this fellowship in the past, and for whom some of the items of furniture or the plaques on the wall are long-standing memories. Those plaques bear their name. And Jesus said, every believer in the church of Philadelphia is like a pillar in the temple, because on their lives is an inscription, and the inscription is the name of Christ. Every single one of us branded in the name. And why is that important? Because if our lives work the way our lives are supposed to work, our lives make it believable that Jesus is coming back. When people look at us, they see a different set of values, different lifestyle. They see people who are living to encourage as many as possible to walk in through the open door. And they look at us in our situation with very little influence, getting into trouble just because we're Christians. They say, why do they do this? And they think to themselves, there's only one reason why they could do this. And that's because they genuinely believe that their master is coming back. Why else would they do it? Why else would their lives bear the mark, the branding? And so they too begin to believe, and they too walk through the door. Jesus said, I don't want you to believe in a better future for the world. I want you to believe that I'm coming back. Our lives make the promise believable. You know, there's a challenge in this to us all. We're not now talking about the corporate leadership or the fellowship. We're now talking about you and me, followers of Jesus Christ. We are the pillars with the inscription of his name upon our lives. There's a challenge to us in this, you know. What do you live in the light of? One of the reasons why I took some time off to think was because I got, you know, 3 or 4 years to do here, if my health holds, to through to some dreadful thing called retirement, and I could be living in the light of the fact there's a day coming when I'll not have to do any more funerals, not have to attend any more session meetings, I'll not have to do this and that and the other thing, and I can be free as a bird to go and do what I want to do and enjoy, if I have health and whatever, you know, I can do all that, and I can live in the light of that. I can count the days down, you know, because every day I live, it gets one day closer to that reality. And you could be living in some reality like that yourself. In your case, it might not be retirement, it might be some special thing that's coming up, a holiday you've planned, a house move that's going to take place in the autumn, a new job that you've been interviewing for and you think you've got, and you're just counting the days till this comes up. And every day that passes is one day closer to this incredible thing coming out. And you and I can live in the light of that, or we can live in the light of something else. Jesus said to the people of Philadelphia, I am coming soon. What on earth did he mean by soon? It was 2,000 years ago, you know. If I told my wife I was going to do something for her soon, it took me 2,000 years, I don't think it would cut mustard somehow. Soon. What does that mean? 2,000 years have passed, Jesus. Come on. Here's the point. Every single day I live, that day is one day closer. The fact that he is coming back is one day closer every night I go to bed. And I can live in the light of some human experience that I'm looking forward to, some change that I anticipate in the future, someone that's going to answer all my prayers and give me the freedom I want, or whatever it is. Or I can live in light of the fact that every day I live is one day closer to Jesus coming back. My life should make that clear to everybody else. And I know that that's hard, you know, because you think, well, like, come on, it's 2,000 years. It doesn't seem any more likely it's going to come now than it did 2,000 years ago, does it? Reality is every day is getting one day closer, and his return could be in my lifetime. How's that even possible? I was in the new build behind us here last Thursday. I had permission. I didn't sneak in this time. And I was with Michael, and I didn't have the relevant hat and jacket on, but apparently it was okay. And we were in there, and we were talking to the foreman. And the building's going to be a couple of weeks late, probably near to the end of June rather than the start of June, whenever it's finished and handed over to us now. And you kind of walk in, you look around, and when you look around, you think, yeah, it's definitely going to take a couple of weeks more. There's an awful lot of work to do here before this building's finished. And you look at the state of the car park and I said, how on earth are they going to get all this done? And then the foreman said this to me. He said, you know, there's a funny thing about building contracts. He said, they go on for months and months and months and it looks like nothing's happening. And then the last 2 weeks, everything happens all at once. And all of a sudden, it's finished. The building's done. 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ made a promise. He said, I'm coming soon. And you look at the history of the church in 2,000 years, and in some ways you think not an awful lot has changed, but it's like a building project, and it's all going to come to a conclusion really quickly in the end of the day. So that we're sitting here today, and I might think in whatever years of time that I have left, Jesus will not come back. The reality is he could be back next week. That's the bottom line. So what am I living in the light of? Eh? Am I living in the light of counting down the things that I'm looking forward to, those human experiences which in themselves are perfectly valid and perfectly enjoyable and nothing wrong with them at all? No reason why I can't have ambitions and hopes and dreams about my life in this world. But what is it that really gives focus to my life? What's the branding on my heart? It's the promise that every day I live is one day closer to the King coming back, and I want to be a part of that. That's Jesus' challenge to us. Firmly believe it. That's what he's saying to us in Carnmoney at this point in time. Jesus is saying to us, I give you a gift. What are you doing with my gift? I opened a door for you. I opened the door and it let you in. If it let you in, you could pretty much figure out there's not very many people I couldn't get in if I could get you in. What are you doing with that gift? What is your collective leadership doing with that gift that God has opened the door before us? That nobody can shut. And I give you a promise. I give you a promise. The branding on your life is meant to make that promise believable in the world in which you live. That every day of the calendar brings the return of Christ one day closer.